On Valentine's Day 2018, what began as a normal school day at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, transformed into a nightmare that would spark a national movement. Within hours of surviving one of America's deadliest school shootings, students began speaking out, refusing to let their tragedy fade from public consciousness like so many before. Their book, Never Again, quickly became a cultural phenomenon, endorsed by celebrities from Ellen DeGeneres to Jimmy Fallon, and praised by political figures across the spectrum. What makes this account so powerful isn't just the harrowing details of the shooting itself, but how it chronicles the birth of a youth-led movement that accomplished what adults had failed to do for decades: shift America's conversation about gun violence. As the Washington Post noted, these teens managed to maintain media attention on gun reform longer than any previous mass shooting, proving that Gen Z's technological savvy and refusal to accept thoughts and prayers could translate into real political impact. David and Lauren Hogg were born into a generation defined by school shootings. Their entire lives unfolded in the post-Columbine era, where active shooter drills became as routine as fire drills. This reality shaped their worldview in ways previous generations couldn't comprehend. While their parents grew up worrying about nuclear war, an abstract threat, David and Lauren's generation faced the very concrete possibility that someone might shoot up their school on any given day. Their childhood in California was relatively idyllic, despite this backdrop. They lived in a beach town near LAX, where their neighborhood transformed into Candy Cane Lane every Christmas, with thousands of visitors walking past their windows nightly to see elaborate displays. Inside their home, they froze because their frugal FBI agent father wouldn't spring for central heating. This early hardship sparked entrepreneurial spirit. They sold cookies, water, and snacks to Christmas crowds at increasingly inflated prices, making hundreds each night. Their father's profession meant guns were a normal part of their household. Watching him clean his service weapon in the garage taught David that firearms were serious tools, never toys. When a gunman killed a TSA agent in the terminal where their father worked, it reinforced why he needed that protection. This background explains why, contrary to what critics would later claim, they still believe in the Second Amendment and have guns in their home. David struggled with undiagnosed dyslexia, labeled as difficult and a slow learner. He didn't learn to read until fourth grade and became deliberately contrarian, planning his days around who he could annoy. But this oppositional nature helped him find his own path, like discovering how to collect lost baseballs from behind the baseball field and exchange them for snacks. Third grade marked a turning point when Miss Jackson showed faith in him, and on Father's Day, he finally learned to ride a bike, going 30 miles the next day. Lauren, meanwhile, was developing her own perspective. She describes David as a protective older brother who once confronted fifth graders who took her soccer ball. Despite his reading difficulties, he took detailed notes and knew more about politics than most adults. Their father's survival lessons and mother's constant reminders to locate exits became part of their consciousness, skills that would later prove crucial. When the Hogg family moved to Florida, the transition proved jarring. The humid climate felt like a hot burp from Satan, and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School was intensely competitive. Two classes, TV production and debate, became David's lifelines, exposing him to complex issues like campaign finance, environmental injustice, and the military-industrial complex. Debate taught him to research thoroughly and check his confirmation bias, skills that would later prove essential to their activism. Forced friendships with debate partners and TV crew members gradually transformed David. They'd gather in the courtyard discussing space, engineering, and politics. Teachers like Miss Boyd and Kyle Jader encouraged him, helping him raise his GPA to 4.2 and explore subjects like feeding populations on Mars. Unfortunately, academic success inflated his ego. He became arrogant, rejecting a girl who offered to pay for his homecoming ticket and making cruel remarks to classmates. By junior year, David recognized his pattern of starting strong and crashing by spring. The demanding coursework nearly broke him, but he decided to transform his approach to life. He structured his days in 30-minute segments like a Silicon Valley startup, waking at 3:30 a.m., studying rigorously, biking to school, and maintaining strict routines. This discipline improved his grades dramatically, culminating in perfect AP exam scores. Beyond academic success, David discovered that compassion made him more efficient than competition. Reading Jeanette Wall's The Glass Castle helped him gain perspective on privilege and suffering, pushing him to become vegetarian, practice meditation, and reduce his carbon footprint. He realized working with people rather than against them was the key to making real change. Lauren, meanwhile, was having her own formative experiences. In seventh grade, she studied school shootings in peer counseling class with Ms. Ryu. They watched PSAs about recognizing warning signs and discussed school safety. That same year in civics with Mr. Grisette, they learned about lobbying groups controlling government. He structured classes around daily questions that made Lauren feel empowered about civic participation, despite not being old enough to vote. Senior year brought David friendship with Emma Gonzalez, initially misjudging her shaved head as trying to be edgy before recognizing her kindness. They bonded over memes, politics, women's rights, and their shared love of space. Emma taught him about accepting differences and showing love openly. In AP government class, they discussed gun politics and the NRA's influence, timing that would prove eerily significant. The day before the shooting, David felt compelled to call Emma to tell her how much he cared about her and that she would change the world. February 14, 2018, began as a day of celebration. The school was filled with chocolates, flowers, and hugs. When the fire alarm went off during Lauren's 2B production class, students initially thought it was just a Valentine's prank. They'd already had a drill that morning. The first sign something was wrong came when kids started running across the bus loop with terror in their eyes. Being an FBI agent's daughter, Lauren had been trained to know exits and stay calm. Her generation had grown up with Code Red drills since kindergarten. When librarians' walkie-talkies went off and they screamed, "Code Red," she rushed back to her classroom and hid in a tiny filming room with friends. The worst part was getting texts. "Someone's shooting into my class. I love you guys so much." Then came blurry videos of people dying. For 3 hours, they sat holding hands, receiving horrific messages about friends being shot. When her phone died, Lauren felt even more helpless. David's experience was equally terrifying. When they heard the first gunshot during AP Environmental Science, students thought it was part of a planned drill with blank rounds. As they evacuated, they encountered others running in panic, accidentally heading toward the shooter until a janitor redirected them. About 60 or 70 students crowded into Chef Kurth's classroom, where she kept insisting, "It's just a drill," to calm everyone. The thud, thud, thud of helicopters finally made David realize this might be real. In that terrifying moment, David's meditation practice helped him stay calm. He instinctively pulled out his phone and started filming. When he got in the car that day, he screamed the whole way home, pounding on the dashboard and shouting "fuck" over and over. Action became therapeutic. He focused on uploading footage and getting the story out rather than processing his emotions. When SWAT finally arrived, they counted students and evacuated them with hands up. Lauren describes seeing her father in the parking lot as the best feeling ever. Parents were running from all directions. But the worst moment came at home when she saw her friends' faces on TV labeled as dead or missing. She screamed so hard, her mother said it sounded subhuman. That's when David decided to go back to the school to talk to reporters. Their parents tried to stop him, but he insisted, "If they don't get any stories, this will just fade away." He took his bike, and that was how everything started. After David left, Lauren collapsed from exhaustion. For weeks afterward, she couldn't maintain normal sleep patterns, passing out early and waking in the middle of the night, a common experience among traumatized classmates. The morning after, she looked at the sunrise and was devastated, realizing her friends would never see it again. Everything felt surreal and foggy. David immediately began speaking on news shows while Lauren remained blinded by grief, only managing a few tweets. Their mother forced Lauren to visit grief counselors at Pine Trails Park Recreation Center, where she encountered classmates she barely recognized through their shared trauma. Even the therapists wept as she told her story. At Friday night's vigil, 17 Christmas angels stood on stage, and Jamie's father spoke about his daughter as the life of the party. Though politicians spoke about gun control, nobody really believed anything would change. Lauren lay in bed thinking about her four friends who died. Gina, the lovable science-loving nerd, Jamie with the biggest heart, Elena, her Mormon friend who was brilliantly smart and funny, and Alyssa, her first friend in Florida with her infectious laugh that earned her the nickname Giggles. Lauren sent her first tweets demanding change rather than comfort. While David was giving interviews, she attended funerals, meeting Jamie's parents for the first time under tragic circumstances. On a trip to California, she appeared on Dr. Phil alongside a Columbine survivor who told her she was now part of a lifelong club of mass shooting survivors. The movement began when Emma connected David with Cameron Caskey and his drama department friends. 2 days after the shooting, they met at Cameron's house to plan their response. They focused on achievable goals, like universal background checks and raising the rifle purchase age from 18 to 21. Cameron suggested the hashtag, #NeverAgain, which they used with full awareness of its Holocaust associations, but felt nothing better expressed their determination. Their strength came from their disorganization. They were just teenagers following their instincts, sleeping on couches, waking for middle-of-the-night interviews, and running to CNN appearances barefoot. Their first test came when an angry confrontation at a park nearly turned violent. Cameron and David climbed on tables, screaming for everyone to calm down, explaining that hatred and division were what got them here in the first place. They didn't plan a publicity campaign. They just acted on instinct. When the NRA started fundraising off their tragedy, they mobilized against them. Their attacks only gave the students a bigger platform. They learned two crucial lessons. Don't let nonsense distract you, and use their attacks to amplify your message. The students refused to play by traditional rules of decorum. When Senator Rubio wouldn't promise to stop taking NRA money at the CNN town hall, Cameron wouldn't let up. Your agenda is protecting us, right? Sarah Chadwick tweeted, "We should change the names of AR-15s to Marco Rubio because they are so easy to buy," which went viral. When Laura Ingraham and others attacked them, they hit back with wit instead of prepared statements. They calculated Rubio's price per student, $1.05, and wore price tags at the March for Our Lives. Their authentic teen voices on Twitter proved more effective than consultant-crafted messaging. Emma gained 1.5 million followers in days, more than the NRA. Regular people supported them through GoFundMe, 4 million, alongside celebrity donors. The March for Our Lives brought 800,000 people to Washington and sparked 800 sister marches worldwide. Almost immediately after the shooting, conspiracy theorists began their relentless attacks on the students. The first wave came through social media, where they discovered Donald Trump Jr. had liked multiple tweets suggesting David Hogg was running cover for his FBI agent father. This escalated when prominent TV host Graham Ledger and far-right website Gateway Pundit began amplifying theories about them being crisis actors, people allegedly hired to pretend to be victims. Lauren Hogg's Instagram account became a battleground, flooded with white supremacists and conspiracy theorists calling her an actress and insisting the entire shooting was staged. Some even created elaborate false narratives about spotting the students at other school shootings. In response to the cyberbullying, Lauren made a strategic decision to tweet directly at Melania Trump, whose platform as First Lady focused on preventing cyberbullying. The tweet went viral, garnering national attention and marking Lauren's definitive entry into the activist movement. Though emotionally drained from constant crying and harassment, she recognized the need to channel her grief into action. When David introduced her to his circle of activist friends, including Emma Gonzalez and Cameron Caskey, she discovered more than just friendship. She found a surrogate family. The love and support in that room created a healing space unlike anything she'd experienced before, providing strength to continue their fight. Returning to Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School 2 weeks after the shooting was a surreal experience that hammered home the permanence of their loss. The empty desks where Alyssa Alahadif and Gina Montalto once sat remained untouched, covered with roses and personal mementos, serving as stark daily reminders of the tragedy. These vacant spaces made it feel sometimes like the entire class had vanished, creating an eerie atmosphere that permeated every school day. The students demonstrated remarkable self-awareness about their sudden prominence in the media spotlight. They openly acknowledged their privilege, how their affluent, predominantly white community in Parkland attracted national attention, while other young activists fighting the same battle, like Tyrath Hemmons, Zion Kelly, and the Liberty City protesters, struggled to get headlines. They highlighted the stark statistics. Children in less privileged communities face double the odds of getting shot, with death rates exceeding those of soldiers serving in Afghanistan. The Parkland students consistently emphasized that they shouldn't be considered the sole voices or stars of the school shooting generation, actively working to amplify other voices and communities affected by gun violence. After recognizing how overwhelming the interconnected problems of gun violence, poverty, education, and military spending can be, the students decided to focus specifically on common sense gun measures that respect both the right to own guns and the right to live. Their carefully crafted 10-point strategy emerged from extensive research and consultation with policy experts, victims' families, and law enforcement officials. The comprehensive plan includes 1. Funding for gun violence research, reversing decades of research restrictions to allow CDC and NIH to study gun violence as a public health crisis. 2. Digitalization of ATF records, modernizing the current paper-based system to create searchable databases that help law enforcement track weapons used in crimes. 3. Universal background checks, closing private sale and gun show loopholes by requiring checks for all firearm transfers. 4. Ban on high-capacity magazines, limiting ammunition magazines to 10 rounds to reduce mass shooting casualties. 5. Assault weapon ban, prohibiting military-style weapons similar to the 1994 federal assault weapons ban. 6. Funding for intervention programs, supporting community-based violence prevention and mental health initiatives. 7. Red flag laws, enabling family members and law enforcement to temporarily remove guns from individuals in crisis. 8. Blocking domestic violence offenders, strengthening existing laws to keep guns away from convicted abusers. 9. Federal solution to interstate gun trafficking, creating consistent national standards to prevent exploitation of weak state laws. 10. Safe storage / mandatory theft reporting, requiring secure storage of firearms and prompt reporting of stolen weapons. The students emphasized that registering to vote and participating in democracy is the crucial 11th point that enables all other reforms. Their movement has achieved significant concrete results within months. The NRA's popularity plummeted to a 20-year low, with their favorability dropping from 58% to 35%. Major companies, including Delta, United, and Enterprise, ended their NRA member discount programs. Dick's Sporting Goods stopped selling assault weapons and raised their minimum age for gun purchases to 21. More than 20 states passed new gun safety laws, including Republican-controlled Florida, which enacted reforms despite fierce NRA opposition. Public opinion has shifted dramatically. Recent polls show that 2/3 of Americans now support reinstating an assault weapons ban, the highest level in 25 years. The movement has also registered hundreds of thousands of new young voters and made gun violence prevention a top electoral issue. Through strategic focus on achievable goals and sustained grassroots activism, the Parkland students have changed both policy and culture around guns in America. The diverse group that came together after the shootings formed an unexpectedly powerful coalition, each member bringing unique strengths to their shared mission. Cameron Caskey emerged as their tireless, energetic power source, working around the clock and accomplishing in days what others said would take months. His rapid-fire determination helped launch the March for Our Lives movement at unprecedented speed. Ryan Deitch wielded humor as a strategic weapon, using wit to disarm opponents and keep spirits high during the darkest moments. His social media presence helped the movement maintain momentum while making complex issues accessible to younger audiences. Delaney Tarr's analytical mind and director's eye proved invaluable in crafting their message and public image. She approached each challenge methodically, ensuring their actions were strategic and well-documented. Jackie Corin became the logistics mastermind, coordinating hundreds of events and maintaining crucial relationships with other activists and organizations. Her ability to manage complex schedules and networks kept the movement running smoothly. Emma Gonzalez, dubbed the misfit among misfits, emerged as their emotional cornerstone, unshakable under pressure, articulate in moments of crisis, and radiating a compassionate strength that earned her the nickname Buddha among the group. Through months of intense activism, their individual identities began to merge into a collective force. Working 18-hour days, sharing meals, crying together, and celebrating small victories created an unbreakable bond. Their shared trauma transformed into shared purpose, and their grassroots approach to healing, through action, through speaking out, through fighting for change, became a form of group therapy none of them had anticipated but all desperately needed. The book's conclusion presents a devastating but essential memorial to school shooting victims, beginning with Columbine and extending through Parkland. Each entry paints a vivid portrait of lives cut short. Alyssa Al-Hadef, 14, whose soccer teammates still write her number on their cleats. Scott Beigel, 35, a geography teacher who died a hero while ushering students to safety. Martin Duque Anguiano, 14, whose friends remember his infectious laugh and dedication to JROT. Nicholas Dworet, 17, who had just received a swimming scholarship to the University of Indianapolis. Aaron Feiss, 37, an assistant football coach who made the ultimate sacrifice by using his body as a shield to protect his students. The memorial continues, carefully documenting each victim's passions, quirks, and dreams. Joaquin Oliver's love of basketball and writing poetry, Meadow Pollock's plans to attend Lynn University, Peter Wang's dedication to helping others. These weren't merely casualties in America's gun violence epidemic. They were children who looked forward to prom, teachers who stayed late to help struggling students, coaches who doubled as mentors and friends. The Parkland activists ensure these stories remain at the forefront of their movement, transforming statistics into faces, names into legacies. Their message is clear. Remember not just how these lives ended, but how they were lived, and honor them by preventing future tragedies. The book concludes with a powerful and heartfelt call to action, challenging readers to become active participants in the fight against gun violence. Drawing from their own transformative journey, the authors share how they discovered the profound power of choosing love over hate, learning to embrace people for their authentic selves rather than condemning them for their shortcomings. They draw inspiration from their school's namesake, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, who dedicated her life to creating meaningful change through persistent advocacy as a journalist, suffragette, and environmental champion. Her legacy teaches them that sustained, daily engagement is the key to transforming society. The authors emphasize that the solution to seemingly insurmountable problems lies in unity and collective action. They've witnessed firsthand how division and polarization fuel the cycle of violence, and they propose a different path forward. Their message encourages grassroots organizing, starting with local communities where individuals can make tangible differences. They stress the importance of standing firm against intimidation, whether it comes from bullies, skeptics, or those who dismiss young voices. Their approach combines practical activism with emotional wisdom, maximizing love, minimizing hate, and maintaining the courage to speak truth to power, like the child who pointed out the emperor's nakedness in the classic tale. This generation brings a unique perspective to the fight against gun violence. Born in the shadow of Columbine, they've grown up with active shooter drills as a routine part of their education, making the threat of gun violence not an abstract concept, but a lived reality. They express both determination and frustration, refusing to accept the fatalistic notion that gun violence is an unsolvable problem. Their commitment extends beyond the pages of their book, honoring not only the victims they've named, but also countless others affected by gun violence across the nation. The authors make it clear that this is not just a temporary movement, but a lifelong commitment. They view ending gun violence as their generation's defining challenge, one they're prepared to face with unwavering resolve. Their call to action is both an invitation and a challenge to readers to join in creating a future where school shootings and gun violence become a chapter in history books rather than recurring headlines. They emphasize that change is possible, but only through sustained effort, collective action, and an unwavering belief in the power of organized, peaceful resistance.